Now, last time I started to talk about Romanticism, and I said that it isn't entirely due, of course, to the new emotional atmosphere injected with Pietism and Evangelism, that there are other important sources which I mentioned last time, so I won't go over them now, but that history, the new interest in history and nature, are of the greatest importance for Romanticism as a way of orienting yourself in the world, of coping with a world that, as we've said so often, is rapidly industrializing. And before I deal with history, I want to deal now with nature as far as Romanticism is concerned. For nature, of course, was more accessible, a greater mobility. It was nearer. At the same time, as I said last time, as you had the destruction of nature by industrialism, you had the greater and greater admiration of nature. And that admiration of nature is, I think, symbolized in the beginning of what we might call the cult of the Alps, or as a book calls it, the rush to the Alps. In a sense, the Alps became, as it were, the expression of nature, what was in the Enlightenment the noble savage, a refreshing of the human spirit. And you get a new idea, especially of the symbolism of the mountain, which isn't much different than the symbolism of the waterfall, which you will read about in Werther. The first important work on the Alps comes as early as 1732 with a long didactic poem published by somebody called Haller. But it's very typical what this was, this poem. It was an attack on the corrupt morals of civilized society, its servility, its hypocrisy. And opposite to the hypocrisy of civilized society, to the search, in a way, the search for truth and for genuineness, came the idealized portrait of the Swiss mountaineer, depicted as simple shepherds, immensely proud and virtuous by nature. Now, all of this is, of course, a way of the noble savage. And in a sense, the cult of the Alps is at the beginning part of the Enlightenment cult of the noble savage, the cult of the Swiss mountaineer, if you like. But it soon becomes something, I think, much more than that, much more important than that. And this was pioneered by the English. It's no accident that Switzerland was discovered by the most highly industrialized nation. Until the Second World War, certainly, the Alps were pioneered by the English. Most alpine peaks were climbed by the English. Most alpine resort towns like Zermatt in the foot of the Matterhorn were discovery and foundations by the English. So that the most industrialized nation discovered Switzerland as a kind of liberation, as a kind of wide open spaces, which were lacking, of course, in England itself, so it was thought with the industrialization. Of course, at the same time, the English discovered their lake district, their own mountains with Wordsworth, but equally important to Wordsworth's poems of the lake districts are Wordsworth's poems about Switzerland. Wordsworth and the English romantic poets discovered both their own mountains and Switzerland. And the Alps and the mountains became a kind of rejuvenation. Again, a landmark was Burke's tract inquiry into the origins of our ideas of sublime and beautiful, this tract of 1786 by Burke sort of put up, if you like, the companion piece to Winckelmann, where Winckelmann had been all taken by Greek symmetry and harmony and moderation. Burke praises the wild Alps. Burke praises the romantic landscape. The mountains are considered sublime, he says, because of the extension in the vertical produces a much greater effect upon the eye than the horizontal. This is not to say that they are necessarily beautiful, beauty being a factor of love. Mountains, however, elicit astonishment and awe. And that is, of course, the romantic idea of mountain. It isn't necessarily Winckelmann's beauty of Greece, symmetry, harmony, moderation. Indeed, the mountains come to stand for something else, stand for astonishment and awe. And you might say, in the whole romantic movement, this becomes, in a sense, a metaphor of nature, astonishment and awe. And Burke's reflections of 1786 on the origins of our ideas of the sublime and the beautiful are, as it were, the companion piece to Winckelmann's History of Ancient Art, except one sets a tone for a certain beauty, moderation, and grace, and the other sets the tone for the romantic admiration of nature. What also helped greatly in discovering of the Alps is not just the macadamization of roads, but also in 1770, the improvement of French roads by Turgot, the great 18th century statesman. That cut in half the traveling time from England to Switzerland. After 1770, that traveling time was cut in half by this improvement of the French roads. And it's really after 1770 that you have the English rush to the Alps beginning. Rousseau had something to do with it as well. The Nouvelle Heloise, or love and mountains, are popularized. But in the end, the mountains come to stand for the awe sublime, but also for the whole paradigm, which we might call the Werther complex. For example, Goethe himself, in 1775, made a famous excursion into the Alps with two companions. All of them in 1775 wore what was called Werther costume. Werther costume, the costume described in the novel you're reading, which became the rage. Blue frock worn over a tan vest and fawn-colored pants. What was called the Werther costume by the Romantics, into the Alps, and again popularized it, clearly as did Wordsworth. But the greatest popularization, or the final popularization of the Alps, didn't come from England. It came from Germany. It came, of course, with a play, as you are all aware, with Schiller's William Tell. Schiller's William Tell performed first in 1804. That connected the Alps not only with awe and sublime, but also with freedom. As the most famous line of Schiller's Wilhelm Tell, after all, we want to be free as our ancestors were free. Wir wollen frei sein, wie unsere Väter wären. So the whole thing about William Tell in 1804 connected the Alps to freedom, political freedom, as well as to the freedom of discovery, the freedom of the heights, the freedom of the open spaces, the awesome and sublime that you now have in the mountains itself. To the rooted peasant of the Enlightenment, you have now the free people of the Swiss Valley, the William Tell legend, which becomes, of course, very important. At the same time, the Alps are discovered, to give you another landmark, in 1786, the highest mountain in Europe was climbed, Mont Blanc. It's not difficult. I've done it about three or four times. Mont Blanc is one of the easiest mountains to climb, actually, because this isn't a very rocky mountain. But Mont Blanc was finally climbed in 1786. The Matterhorn had to wait for another 60 years because it's, of course, much more difficult to climb as a rock. But gradually, by the 1860s, all alpine peaks had been climbed. By the 1860s, there wasn't an alpine peak that hadn't been climbed, and usually by Englishmen who did it for adventure. The native Swiss did it for money. The English did it for adventure. So that you had it there for this discovery of Switzerland, which goes with this romanticism of the mountains as the central piece in many ways of the romanticism of nature. The English predominated. You have, therefore, the mystique, the open spaces, the acting out of a challenge different than at home. And again, this can be easily illustrated by an extract from the most celebrated English mountain book by Mallory, and never mind, one of the most celebrated English mountain books, which goes this way. Have we vanquished an enemy? None except ourselves. That this is a form of sport in which one makes one's own rules, set one's own goals, the highest form of expression which can ever be found, the highest form of test and the highest form of challenge. For sport, we think of it as a battle, the quality which has made Englishmen famous. In other words, the Alps were another sport at a time, as you will see when in Tom Brown, sports began to be important in the English schools, above all, when athletics and sports almost became a mania. The Alps were a sport, but they were more than a sport. They were the last test of manliness available. This is going to be a big problem. The English had it easier, too. They had another test of manliness, the empire. But apart from the test of manliness in the empire, made famous by Kipling, you had a second test of manliness, climbing mountains, climbing the Alps. A test of manliness and, as it were, at the same time, of course, the awe and all of that sort of thing. Now, this was yet for an elite. Mass travel to the Alps cannot come until the 1840s, not until the railways are built, and there are railways which go to Switzerland, and in 1848, I think, is the first Cook's tour to Switzerland, and then the rush is on. And then it will remain on, of course, until this day. So it's not until the 1840s that you can have mass tourism. But before that, you already have in art, of course, accompanying all of this, the pictures that you see in my culture book, the pictures of the Romantic Alps. Two other things were especially put into the Alps. Inasmuch as we shall see, the admiration of history was an admiration for Catholicism, there was a special affinity between monks and Alps. And so you get that famous metaphor, which everybody was brought up on still in my generation, the monastery in the Alpine Valley, the St. Bernard dog rescuing the lost traveler with the bit of rum around his neck. One of the most famous romantic poems, there must be hundreds of these poems, of these St. Bernard dogs and the monastery in the background and the Alps and everything in a way brought together. The awl, the monk, and of course the faithful animal, human domination, human awe, open spaces, adventure, test, religion, history, everything is in these kind of paintings which the Romantics prized so much. If you want to read more about all of this, you can read this book by Paul P. Bernard called The Rush to the Alps, The Evolution of Vacationing in Switzerland. It's quite interesting, and it is extremely important. It is extremely important. The history of tourism is not yet written, but it's an extremely important history, of course, because it concerns people's leisure, people's ambition, and the meaning of mountain, and the meaning of landscape. I told you once before, and I just want to repeat it briefly, that when Petrarch went up a mountain in the 13th century, he sat down on top of the mountain and read St. Augustine, and as you might say, a sudden humility, religion, and God. Now, when you climb the mountain, it is a test. You don't read St. Augustine. You look at the landscape. You have a feeling of having proved your manliness. You have a feeling of getting away from civilization, which has gone wrong, industrial civilization, into the open spaces, yes? And all of this sort of thing, which is quite different in nature. Now, all of this idea of nature, goes hand in hand with Goethe's famous saying that he who believes in systems expels love from his heart. There you see. The awesome mountain, the awesome nature in your Werther reading too, expels systems. He who likes systems expels love from his heart. Therefore, it is a mood which opposes restraint and which also personalizes everything, which we'll see soon in nature. But it is again a total mood. It takes on art. It includes animals and people and mountains and architecture, as well as you will read in my culture book, and I won't say much about it anymore, architecture, art, and everything of this nature. Now the great summary, which stands at the beginning of Romanticism, is at one point, if you like, the metaphor of the mountain. All this together for the elite that could go to Switzerland, for which it had all this meaning, the beginning of romantic poems and romantic poetry of Wordsworth and others in Germany and England, but also in France. But also at the beginning of Romanticism stands a novel which brings it all together. And that novel which brings it all together is, of course, Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe of 1819. This brings it all together on another level, a literary level, but a literary level that became so popular that it really did more than any other document, except Werther, to fix the romantic mood in the European conscience, or if you like, in Europe. Ivanhoe is, of course, a novel about in the Middle Ages, typically, set in the Middle Ages, in a period as far removed as possible from the present, in the Middle Ages. And it is a novel which has a famous description of Romanticism in it, which I will now read you, and it is a description which has to do with nature. It is right at the beginning of the book, a description of nature. There are many descriptions of nature. Literature is now full of nature descriptions. Nature now becomes an integral part of the plot, not just something as a setting, but an integral part of the plot. The scene, says Scott, was singularly romantic. on the verge of a wood which approached to within a mile of the town of Ashby, was an extensive meadow of the finest and most beautiful green turf, surrounded on one side by the forest and fringed on the other by straggling oak trees, some of which had grown to an immense size. Now, you have several things here. You have size, like mountains, always very important, the awesome. And you have the forest. It's not just that the famous German forest begins here, the Germanic forest of pines, but the English have a similar kind of forest worship as the German. The English forest, the German forest, all of that sort of thing. The ground, as if fashioned on purpose, sloped gradually down to all sides to a level bottom, which was enclosed, and then it goes on and on. Now, the important similes here are three, then. There is the size, the grandeur of nature. There is the forest, the darkness. It's nature's cathedral. It's nature's cathedral, the dark and mysterious forest. It becomes a national symbol in Germany, the German forest. In English, perhaps less so. And there is thirdly another thing, the meadow. The meadow with flowers, the sweetness, and the flowers. Now that leads in Germany to the most important and famous metaphor for Romanticism, the famous blue flower of the Romantics. The blue flower of the Romantics, which becomes famous in Germany, invented, if you like, by a poet by the name of Novalis in a play, if you must know, called Heinrich von Ofterdingen. The play is really not that important. Around 1800. Be exact, 1802 or 3. In that play, Novalis gives the following scene, a scene that will become a metaphor from 1802 to the German youth movement before and after the First World War. Quite unthinkable without this metaphor. And it is as follows, that Heinrich von Ofterdingen, the hero, lay down on a meadow, a verdant meadow, a green meadow with a lot of flowers. A green meadow, a lot of flowers. And as he lay down on the meadow, he saw a blue flower. And this blue flower, the more he looked at it, the more remote it became. And the more he tried to grasp it, the more remote it became. And eventually in that scene, the blue flower becomes part of the meadow itself, part of the cliffs near the meadow. It dissolves into the landscape. It becomes a kind of metaphor for longing, for utopia, for innocence. Why the color blue? Well, it's difficult to say, but remember again, the color blue is an important Christian liturgical color, and therefore a very deep kind of color in Western civilization, a very important color, a Christian liturgical color. So the blue flower, which you want to grasp, but you can never grasp, whose beauty is obvious, because it is a beauty not only of the flower, but of the meadow, of nature as good and beneficent and sweet. And so the metaphor of flower and nature becomes extremely important. It is, in fact, in the last resort, a metaphor of innocence. So as we can say that the longing for mountains is a metaphor for the longing for awe, for astonishment, for stupefaction. The metaphor of the forest is a metaphor for the mystic. The metaphor of the meadow is instead a metaphor, really, of innocence, just as the metaphor of flower is a metaphor of innocence. And now, in a sense, the flowers come into their own. Both the rose which sprouts from the womb of woman, as I told you last time, as a metaphor of the innocence of woman and as the color of the Virgin Mary. And the blue flower of the German Romantics, another symbol of innocence, but a symbol both of innocence on the one hand and of utopia on the other, the famous blue flower of the Romantics. But there isn't only nature and the blue flower. There is here another factor, the factor of the mysterious Orient. And that is symbolized by a Jewess, Rebecca. Now, Rebecca will be the ideal woman at the beginning of the 19th century. She will set the tone for women together with Charlotte. Charlotte in Werther and Rebecca. Rebecca is described with all the titillation of the Orient. I will read her description. The brilliance of her eyes, the superb arch of her eyebrows, her well-formed aquiline nose, the Jewish nose becomes benevolent, her well-formed aquiline nose, her teeth as white as pearl, and the profusion of her sable tresses, which, each arranged in its own little spiral of twisted curls, fell down upon as much of a lovely neck and bosom as a simar of the richest Persian silk, exhibiting flowers in their natural colors, you see the flowers again, embossed upon a purple ground, permitted to be visible. All these continued a combination of loveliness which yielded not to the most beautiful of the maidens who surrounded her. This then is Rebecca, and Rebecca's Oriental beauty, Persia, flowers, all of this, again, woman now brought into the proximity not only of the Orient and of flowers. Needless to say, Rebecca herself, also in her character, exhibits these qualities, the best qualities. She could not indeed imitate the excess of subservience. The enemy is always the Jewish man. There's a great difference between the cowardly, puny, and ugly Jewish men from now and then and the Jewish woman. The Jewish woman becomes a metaphor of beauty and desirability. The Jewish man in the 19th century, the Jew boy, is a metaphor of puniness, sliminess, and cowardliness, also in Sir Walter Scott, but not in Sir Walter Scott only. The father of Rebecca, Simon of York, is a coward. She could not indeed imitate his excess of subservience, because she was a stranger to the meanness of mind and to the constant state of timid apprehension by which it was dictated. But she bore herself with a proud humility, as if submitting to the evil circumstances in which she was placed as the daughter of a despised race, while she felt in her mind the consciousness that she was entitled to hold a higher rank from her merit than the arbitrary despotism of religious prejudice. So Rebecca rises above it. Rebecca is the proud Jewess, a metaphor for woman, very important in the 19th century, as I said, against the Jewish men. Masculinity is confined to Christians. Masculinity is something else again. But women, the proud Jewess, that was fine. Again, it's a kind of indifference, really, towards women. Again, it's a kind that women are allowed things men are not allowed in a man where men dominate. In a man where the men dominate, they have to be a certain type. But with women, there is a greater largeness of mind. And indeed, the Oriental always appeals as making woman more attractive, more mysterious, up to Agatha Christie detective stories, after all, in our own day, making him more appealing. So you get a very famous and, if I may say, fateful division between Jewish men and women, which still occupied Adolf Hitler in many ways. becomes very important. A Jewish woman is a metaphor of sex, of a certain kind of sex, desirable sex. But at the same time, Ivanhoe is, as it were, a metaphor also of knighthood. The ideal is, of course, again a medieval ideal. It mixes in history, the ideal of knighthood. And the hero of the book is Richard II, the lion-hearted, who went on a crusade and all this. I won't go into the plot. But King Richard, and King Richard, the hero of the book, is described as follows by Sir Walter Scott. Yes. Adventure was the zest of life to Richard Coeur de Lion, and it had its highest relish when enhanced by the dangers encountered and surmounted. In the lion-hearted king, the brilliant but useless character of a knight of romance was in great measure realized and revived. And the personal glory which he acquired by his own deeds of arms was far more dear to his excited imagination than that which a course of policy and wisdom would have spread around his government. His reign was like the course of a brilliant and rapid meteor which shoots along the face of heaven, his feats of chivalry furnishing themes for bards and minstrels, but affording none to those solid benefits his country, which history loves to pause and hold up to posterity. In other words, what is glorified is the opposite of settled government. Or what is glorified is the king of adventure, the king like a metaphor, the king who likes personal combat. In other words, here you see the personalization, the knight who fights in personal combat, and who is so opposite, Sir Walter Scott said, to the solid benefits over which, to a country over which history pauses. But he glorifies that. He glorifies that. And here again, in Richard Coeur de Lion, in Ivanhoe, I think you can see very well the longing for personalization. For in the last resort, the Romantics personalized the mountain. The mountains was your test, yes? Your test, your awe, your astonishment. What was important in the mountain was how he reacted upon you. What was important in the shepherd dog is how he rescued you with his little barrel of brandy around his neck. What was important about the monk is not the monk, but how he reminds you of the Middle Ages. A better time. So everything is already personalized here, quite clear. And the ideal ruler is the knight who has no settled policy, who rules by combat. How can you personalize politics better than by knightly combat? Now this will remain. And that will be very important. For whenever man now faces a technological innovation which is menacing, he tries to approximate it to knighthood or to medieval vocabulary. The greatest example is aviation, and above all in the First World War, the aviators, something entirely new, are called knights of the sky, and they thought of themselves as knights. So in other words, this whole idea of the medieval, this whole idea of knighthood, of nature, becomes a way of, what I would say, mediating modernity, being able to cope with modernity, being able to face it and confront it and reduce it to something that you can understand. So, oddly enough, especially in modern war and especially in the First World War, a medieval vocabulary will become very important, and so will nature. Behind the trenches, the soldiers lay in the meadows. The nature behind the trenches becomes terribly important in the First World War. Undisturbed nature as a kind of symbol of innocence. The soldier's bathing poem, soldiers bathing in the nude becomes a poem in the First World War, almost commonplace in Germany and England, as a kind of metaphor of the search for innocence in nature is over against this terrible war, these terrible conditions of the trenches with which you somehow have to cope, and you cope it by calling to your aid innocent nature, the landscape behind the trenches, all of this sort of thing, counting to the aid, thinking in metaphors. Always man does that when confronted with the horrible, with the new, with things of which he cannot cope. At the same time, in this romanticism, there is involved, of course, also always the idea of timelessness. And perhaps before we go to Werther, I can sum it around that. I can sum it up around that. The mountains stand for timelessness. Not only open spaces, but timelessness. And they will so until the modern times. If you follow mountain literature, mountains are timeless. You'd climb the mountains and you are timeless. So that I can make it clear to you by a famous saying of Rousseau in his Confessions, his romantic book, The Confessions, in which Rousseau says, thanks heavens, in which in a famous scene, Rousseau throws away his watch and he says, thank heavens, I shall no longer need to know what time it is. And he says that and he throws away his watch in a passage describing the beauties of nature. The beauties of nature. Nature is, of course, a metaphor of timelessness. Mountains, nature in general, the model, the meadow, and the blue flower. The blue flower is timeless. You're always trying to grasp it lying in a meadow, yes? It's one thing, the metaphor of timelessness. Similarly, the idea of knighthood, the medieval vocabulary we use to cope with modern troubles, with modern concerns, timeless. For the essence is that people want to annex a bit of eternity. The only way you can cope with modernity is to annex a piece of eternity into your own life. And that piece of eternity is a romantic piece of eternity. It comes in a way from the romantics. It's nature, the skies, timelessness. But it is always in the last resort personalized because in reality, it is you who are always at the center. So what you have therefore here is the idea of timelessness, the metaphor of timelessness, which is so important. And if Rousseau said, I throw away my watch on the in nature, then there are many quotations, even in modern times, where people say, there's one famous one, as a matter of fact, from Nazi times, in the Second World War, where some bodies climbed a mountain in the middle of the war and said, how wonderful, here there is no war, here there is no need for a post office, you see. There is no need at all. It becomes a very narcissistic thing, this rush to the Alps. But you can trace it in another way too, in Germany especially, through the new concern with the American Indian, through the new American Indian novel, which starts the novels about South and North Dakota and the American Indians, which will climax at the end of the century with the height of industrialization. The kind of nostalgia for the wide open spaces which industrialization brings with it, which was very important in Romanticism, very important. And where you didn't have the wide open spaces, at least you had the mountains, which gave you awe. And at least you had the wood, which was nature's cathedral. That's even, after all, a phrase, nature's cathedral. Now, with all of this, of course, Rousseau's Confessions of 1783 must be added as a basic document, perhaps, to Ivanhoe and to Werther. And Rousseau, of course, makes it very direct. These beautiful countries upon which nature has only lavished her gifts to make them prey of the barbarous tax collector. In other words, with Rousseau very clearly the contrast between the genuineness of nature, the idea of genuineness involved here, and modern government comes off very clearly. The barbarous tax collector has made the prey of nature. O nature, O my mother, behold me under thy protection alone. Here there is no cunning or knavish mortal to thrust himself between me and thee. This is almost like the blue flower of the Romantics. There is no cunning, no knavish mortal. There is only innocence in nature. There is only innocence in nature, only man's soul. Nature is always good. Nature is always good, and when it isn't good, at least it is awe-inspiring. And when it isn't good, is it you who makes it evil? This is clear in Werther, by the way. I'll come back to that. Because nature really does not exist in the end outside you. Nature is a part of you. It is a part of your quest for timelessness, your quest for personalization, your quest to cope with factories where there were fields, your quest to cope with modern war. And remember, at the beginning of the 19th century were the first general wars that were not fought by mercenaries, but by people, the wars of the French Revolution. I'll come to that. Your way of coping modern war, your way of coping with the advances of technology. Now, you know this, of course, in another way. This is a continuing trend, but I think it becomes somewhat less important. I mean, we've had the flower children, and we had your elder brothers here who went out and lived in the woods of the state of Washington and things of this nature, yes? I still know people, friends of mine, shall be nameless, who live in the woods of Wisconsin in Portage or around there or wherever. So there is still this idea that somehow you can withdraw in the same search, but here it is generalized now. Here it is generalized. It becomes important. Now I should think it is a sectarian phenomenon, really. There it was generalized and becomes an important phenomenon standing at the beginning of modernity, after all. The beginning of modernity, it'd be interesting to see if most industrializing countries have that same kind of phenomenon. Now, from what I've said, it must be clear that Romanticism goes much beyond pietism and evangelism. But they did inject an emotional atmosphere into it, an emotional atmosphere. And that, of course, it is, in a way, a revolt against the Enlightenment, a revolt against modern government, a revolt against systems, a revolt against bureaucratization, a revolt of what Rousseau calls the taxpayer who despoils nature, after all. Now, all of this quite clearly leads us into Werther. Because, in a sense, Werther is, of the three documents, Ivanhoe and Rousseau's Confession, of course, as I said last time, the one that has lasted. And I think it has lasted because it isn't really a summary of Romanticism. It isn't a summary of Romanticism. History isn't there. The knights are not there. There's no knighthood in Werther. There are no cathedrals in Werther. There are no monks in Werther. Nothing like that. The personalization is driven to its height. There is only Werther. There is only the kind of narcissism which has, after all, such a very great appeal and which, again, is a way of escaping the golden cage. But of course, we know there is no way of escaping the golden cage. But you might say, all this course is about men trying to escape the golden cage, which they've made for each other, or which they have made, or the problems of men living in society, always the same problem, to try and escape the golden cage and to try and escape the horrors of modern life. the horrors of Mars life and all on Mars death and all that is involved. Now it is clear in Goethe's Werther, as we start to look at it, that the correspondence between man and nature is a correspondence between Werther's soul and nature. In a sense, it doesn't really matter whether the waterfall existed. He could have invented it. Yes? I don't know if you agree with this. But a correspondence. And it is also this other thing, the search for the genuine. That's involved, of course, the search for the genuine. And finally, and the great lesson of this, the genuine is always the pre-industrial. That is why we always have this pre-industrial nostalgia. When we look for the genuine, we don't go to the factory, we go to nature. When we look to the genuine, it's always pre-industrial. And that is why all nationalism in the end will have pre-industrial imagery. Right? It'll go back to pre-industrial. The genuine is always for us the pre-industrial. And Romanticism will firm this idea of the genuine as the pre-industrial. No factory enters in Werther, and no factory enters in any Nazi film either. So nationalism rejects that completely.